Tape 4, Side A of the interview with Professor Matthews on the 29th of July 1991. And we were talking about leadership and research.
The public finance lecturer that I inherited, John Head, was something of a sleeper at that stage. He'd been a member of the economics department before I went to the ANU for some years, but he'd never published anything. And although we knew he was very good, we weren't able to get a promotion through for him because of lack of publications. And I think he found this somewhat difficult to accept, but nevertheless we had no idea of what was going to happen, because after this long period when he hadn't published anything, he suddenly blossomed, and publications, first-rate publications, started to flow from him regularly, and in a few years he'd developed an international reputation, and even by the time he left the ANU to go to a chair at Halifax, Nova Scotia, he would have been accepted as one of the world's leading theoretical economists in the public finance field, and he's gone on to develop that area. I can't claim any credit for that at all, because he was then and still is he was then a loner. He's very much involved in working with the small group of public finance economists now, organising conferences and that sort of thing. But most of the other people I was able to assist, because their interests were closer to mine. My interest in public finance was mainly on the public policy side.
Just on that question of the loner, there's an obvious difference between historians and economic historians, and I think that applies in most universities, where historians are generally loners and economic historians tend to work in groups. Is prevalent in accounting and public finance for group work to be the norm?
I think the only way to answer that is to say it happens quite a bit. Usually a couple of people might work together. This was certainly my experience through the whole of my academic life. A lot of my major books were done jointly with one or usually one other author, and I found this a good way to work.
But rarely three or four, say, working as a group?
I mentioned the Academy of Science publication. That was working five of us. No, I think in other cases it was always two people. I think I had an article published in when I was in UCLA with two of the UCLA staff members, but that was fairly unusual. That was three people, and three tends to be more of a crowd than two to work with. For a short article, you can do it, but even for most of the articles that I've written, I've been with one, either by myself or with one other person. I think that's probably all I wanted to say about staff. Maybe we could just finish off on students. I was talking about the lack of accountability of some staff members towards students. One of the results of this was the student movement that took off overseas but wasn't long in being followed in Australia, the so-called student revolt. I've explained that I think to a large extent it was due to lack of accountability on the part of staff. One of the consequences of this was that governing bodies, usually the initiatives came from governing bodies, sometimes it was lower down, started to insist on a greater consultation with students on all the matters that affected students, courses, examining and so on. And this led to the development of student committees at the departmental level, the faculty level, the board level, and student representation on council. Now, in principle, the idea of student representation is good, I think, but in universities, I think it's been carried to extreme length because it's resulted in a proliferation of committees that make it virtually impossible to for staff members to devote sufficient time to their job of teaching and research. In other words, administration, even for the individual staff member not involved in administrative activities as head of department or sub-dean of a faculty, now engages in a much greater proportion of administrative work than I think is healthy for an institution of learning. By the time, I was involved more than most people when I was dean, but even after I ceased being dean in the Faculty of Economics, I found that I could have quite conscientiously filled in the whole of my time every day of the week from 9 to 5 simply doing my teaching and taking part in the various administrative activities, committees and faculties and board meetings and so on. As a member of council, one was involved in other committees from time to time. When I came back from UCLA, I was chairman of the university computer committee. I subsequently became chairman of the superannuation committee. These things are all necessary work, but it meant that instead of individual action being taken by administrators, no action was ever taken without reference to about 10 different decision-making processes. I think the whole decision-making process in the university tended to break down because of the failure to delegate any responsibility to individuals to make decisions. This contrasted a good deal with the American system, of course, where the dean of a school or faculty had an enormous capacity to make decisions. It went too far there, I think, because they'd make autocratic decisions without reference to the senior members of staff, although sometimes there were small cliques of staff members who would themselves wield undue influence. But something of a middle ground, I think, needs to be found. I found in this inquiry into accounting education last year that ordinary lecturers and even tutors are involved to an unnecessary extent in in decision-making processes. They should be involved mainly in discussions about courses and teaching, and not to the extent that it interferes with their task, especially when they're young, to develop their lecture material and get started on their research work. I'm sure it is having that effect now. It's impeding both of these activities. When the really serious troubles started in the university in the 1970s, I just about moved out of teaching, so I wasn't very closely involved. Except that I remember going to some meetings where the extent of student participation was discussed. Students themselves, I think, went a bit overboard during that period. There was some intimidation, and a few student politicians tended to take over what was, I think, a real grievance, and exploit it for their own purposes. Maybe the next thing we should talk about is courses. I explained that when I came to the ANU, we developed new accounting courses with more of an academic orientation. That included the third year courses in government accounting and national accounting. On the public finance side, we expanded the number of courses in public finance, which involved initially one full year's work into what became four semesters' work when the semester system was introduced, so that it became possible for ANU economics students to specialise in public finance and government accounting, and a lot of them did. This was very appropriate, of course, in the ANU, where so many of our students came from the public service with interests in these areas. When I came back from, while I was in UCLA, I did a computer programming course. I think we talked about my interest in computing, not as a person with any experience in computing, but with the belief that computing was an essential part of academic courses in economics and business and accounting. I found in UCLA that computer courses were well established, and in fact, in the last quarter, I did a course myself for the first time. Computing in those days was very different from what it is now. It was 25 years ago, and there were no personal computers. All computer courses had to pass their assignments through the giant university computer, which meant that you worked on punch cards in those days, and it meant that you had to punch up your cards and put them in overnight, and if you were lucky, you got the output back the next day. If you had made the slightest mistake in your programming, you had to write your own programs. If you made the slightest mistake in your programming, leaving a comma out or something like that, you got a no-go, and you had to do it again the next night. So it was quite an effort to do all this, but it was a marvellous discipline, having to write your own programs. And it seemed to me to be important that economics and accounting students should be introduced to computing as soon as possible in their courses. There are no computing courses in Australian universities at that stage, I think, except in engineering schools, which were concerned with the nuts and bolts hardware of computing and the software, the programs were really not being developed at that stage that were suitable for accounting and economics courses. I think it's fair to say that. In fact, my assignment in the UCLA course took the form of an attempt to write up a program for a complete accounting system in a matrix form, which was relatively easy to do on the computer because of the way in which the computer can handle those problems. And when I got back to Australia, I wrote up the program, and it was published in an Australian accounting journal. And a few months later, I got a request from a computer journal, an academic computer journal in the United States, asking whether they could reprint the paper. It was so unusual that somebody had done a paper like that. But that was my only foray into computing, but I nevertheless came back with this conviction that computing needed to be introduced into accounting and economics courses. There was no difficulty within the faculty. Again, the faculty was still cohesive. There was a member of the staff called Barry Smith, who wanted to teach computing. Forgotten where he came from, actually. He was, for those days, relatively advanced in the applications of computing to the commercial side. And I think he might have been working with a computer firm. I'm not sure. Anyway, he put up a blueprint for a computing course, which wasn't very advanced. It was meant to be an introductory course lasting, I think, one term in those days. I think we got that through the faculty all right. I think it was going to be part of one of the accounting courses, maybe Accounting 2. I think it was going to be an add-on course to Accounting 2, I think, that Accounting 2 students were going to be required to do. But we then found difficulty in getting through the board. Not sure whether it was then or later I was chairman of the computer committee of the university, whose main concern was to vet the proposals for a new advanced computer that the ANU was interested in getting cooperation with CSIRO. It was a joint, and CSIRO and university people were working together on this. But one of the problems that became apparent when I was working on the computer committee for the ANU was that there were many people in the ANU who didn't believe that computing was an academic discipline. The ANU, even in those days, had a scholar as director of the Computer Centre, Mark Osborne, who wanted to get on to private research on computing, but there were people in the university that regarded this as improper. I think the computer centre was attached to the Research School of Physical Sciences, and everybody thought that he was there as their dog's body, simply as a service person, and that the computer centre shouldn't conduct its own research. Was a major division, I think, in the university at that time. It's interesting to note that Mark Osborne has stayed on in the university, and he's now a fellow of the Academy of Science. Presumably, I don't know what he's been doing since then, but presumably as a result of his own research work. Anyway, the proposal for this computing course in the faculty ran into difficulties, and we pushed it through, but not without opposition. From then on, I think computing was taken under the wing of the statistics department, and eventually became a department in its own right. The other course that I foolishly, perhaps in light of my Adelaide experience, wanted to introduce when I came back to the ANU was a Master of Administrative Studies, but this time the emphasis being on public administration rather than business administration. And once again, there was no problem in getting this proposal for a master's degree through faculty. There was opposition. There may well have been opposition from the Department of Political Science. I've forgotten. Anyway, it was pushed through faculty. There was certainly opposition in other parts of the university. And at a time when funding was becoming a little tighter in the ANU, even after the program was established, it became very difficult to get funds for staffing. A professor was appointed, Jim Cutt, and I think he may have got one other post, but the enrolments for this were pretty good. There was not the requirement on the same requirement on the thesis as there had been in Adelaide, and in getting the program established, Jack Crawford, the Vice Chancellor, had insisted that I get the support of Fred Wheeler, who was the head of the Public Service Board at that time, to ensure that the public service would in fact support the program. That support was forthcoming. We got the students, but Jim Cutt was continually frustrated in getting staff. And that program also lapsed some years after I'd left the department to take over the research school of, the Research Centre of Federal Financial Relations.
Where did the opposition come from chiefly, and what form did it take? Can you recall some of the debates?
Not really. It was similar, I think, in its scope to the debate that we'd had in Adelaide about whether administrative studies were an academic discipline, and whether it was appropriate to have a coursework degree with a lot of different disciplines represented in that degree. It seems ludicrous now, 20 years later, that these were regarded as real issues in view of the developments that had taken place in America over the previous 70 years or so. But it was still a very strong feeling around Australia. Universities, one has to say, are about the most conservative of all institutions. Almost everything I've had to do in a university once had to fight to get, because they go against tradition. And sometimes tradition can be can have a sensible role in checking developments to make sure that they're wise, but sometimes tradition is completely stultifying in its effects, and that's certainly been my experience in proposals for new courses. I mean, virtually every university now has multidisciplinary master's coursework programs, and why it was so difficult to get the first ones established, I don't know.
Can you recall sophisticated debates about the nature of disciplines and how this will undermine what a discipline is supposed to do, and so on?
Not really, because a lot of the debate came not at the faculty level where the disciplines were actually involved, but at other levels, at the board level or not sure about council. Council did tend to accept the advice of the board on matters like that, so I don't think there was any overt opposition at council level. I think one would have to say, this was certainly true of Adelaide, that part of the opposition to the establishment of new programs arose from funding constraints and people believing that these new programs would have adverse effects on their own funding. And this seems to me to be something that universities need to take up, the idea that every existing program never has to be reviewed to consider whether it's worth continuing. New programs, if there's a given level of funding, new programs ought to be considered not only on their own merits, but also in the light of what's being done in existing programs. I think it's been much too easy for existing departments in universities, even when they're moribund, to maintain their share of resources and to resist proposals for new programs, no matter what their merits might be.
As Peter Carmel once said, history is very powerful.
Yeah, that's right. That's probably all I need to say about courses at that stage. We'll get back onto this general theme when we talk about the foundation of the centre.
You were going to move on, I think, to say something about your role in the creation of CCAE.
Yeah. When I came back from America at the beginning of 1967, I was asked to join the interim council of the Canberra College of Advanced Education, which had just had its first meeting, I think, before I joined the council. It followed an inquiry by Joe Burton into the possibility of a CAE for Canberra. The advanced education sector had been established in the early 1970s, in the 60s. As early as that, was it? The early 1960s, following the Martin Report. Yeah. I'd actually written one of the chapters for the Martin Report, the one dealing with business and accounting and economics. Peter Carmel was on the Martin Committee, and he was still a professor of economics in Adelaide in those days, and he got me to do the draft of the report on these subjects for the Martin Committee. Yes, the Martin report must have been around about 64, was it, that came out?
63, perhaps? 63. I'm not sure.
That. Yeah, about that time. Then the advanced education sector was set up. Most of the advanced education institutions were the old technical institutions, such as RMIT and other institutions of that kind in the States, and I'm not sure whether there were one or two new institutions being established, but I think almost wholly they were transformations of existing institutions. But the Commonwealth government presumably got Joe Burton to head up an inquiry following some pressure in the ACT to see whether there was a case for a similar institution in the ACT, and Joe Burton's report had recommended strongly that there should be such an institution. The Commonwealth set up this interim council to plan it, with an indication that funding would be forthcoming.